The Guardian. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Tottenham's Champions League hopes hang by a thread after a Hugo Lloris red card and a host of wasted chances mean they only draw against PSV. Late again, United are outclassed by Juventus. Man City and Liverpool turn on the style to go top of their groups. And back in the Premier League, a Mesut Ozil masterclass has Arsenal fans dreaming again. All that, plus we'll discuss the biggest talking points from the Football League, look ahead to the weekend's action, get your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel today. John Bruin.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
It's
good.
Early.
Sorry about that, that's my fault.
That's
but
okay.
Everyone was here on time, weren't they? So, good start.
Yes.
Including you, Paolo Bandini?
Including me, yeah. They even let me in without a fuss this morning. It's almost like I've been working here for literally every year since the office opened, to varying degrees.
Jonathan Wilson said the same on Monday, actually. He said it's been 12 years since he's started coming here, and for the first time he didn't have to get a visitor pass.
Yeah.
So we're making progress. Barry, did they let you in the building this morning?
I am. There were coronets and nice ladies sort of throwing leaves in my path as I walked into the office, as is customary. I think after a certain number of years of service, when you become institutionalised like I have, you get that privilege.
Well, I suppose respected journalists everywhere get that sort of welcome, don't they?
Well, it's the least we deserve, but ye will never know.
Thanks for that. We'll start with Manchester United and more misery for Jose Mourinho. They lost 1-0 at home to Juventus. Before we get on to the game, United delayed by traffic yet again, the second Champions League game in a row at Old Trafford that that's happened. How is that? I don't understand how that happens. It's not ideal preparation, is it, for any team?
Well, I think the problem is that they plan to get to the ground only about an hour before kickoff, whereas perhaps in the past, you know, teams arrive 2 hours before the game or 3 hours, and they dine at a hotel down the road and then make their way up there. Now there is the traffic around Old Trafford has been bad since the ground was built, since they got rid of the tram sometime in the 1970s, I would have thought. But I think
so. You're saying they haven't had time to prepare for these eventualities?
Well, you know, fail to prepare, prepare to fail, I suppose, as Roy Keane used to say probably every week. I don't know. What does that suggest about Manchester United? It suggests continuing disorganisation and a club fraying at the edges.
Does it suggest that the players should start following it? I'm trying to think. I think it was a member of ZZ Top for a gig in London took the tube to his own concert, and could we see a shift to Manchester United players taking the tram?
So you remember Christian Gross, mm-hmm. when he
his travel card,
he
yeah.
waved his travel card, and actually Jose Mourinho did walk, didn't he?
Last, in a hoodie apparently.
Yeah, it was only half a mile away that they were dining, but he could get the thing is he couldn't actually get the metro there because I think they were dining next to where the nearest metro was.
Right.
So
okay.
Yeah.
There was a tweet, I don't know how true it is, probably not true at all, because Jose said he wasn't recognised, but someone said that his mate did recognise him walking down the street and said, "Why don't you stay at Hotel Football?" And he apparently said, "I'd rather stay in a zoo."
I've stayed at Hotel Football once, and it's quite pleasant. Got a lot of free, unnecessary, but nevertheless all-consumed sweets in your room at Hotel Football.
I assume that Jose was referring to that because it's owned, in inverted commas, by Gary Neville, Ryan Giggs.
Perhaps that's
the various class of 92. And actually, it was built against the club's wishes. It's built on the very edges of the Old Trafford forecourt. It's something that Ed Woodward and the Glazers didn't want. And it's something that I don't think they like looking out on because it does tower above the forecourt there. And considering the criticism that Jose Mourinho's received from that group of owners, I doubt he'll be catching a few beers down there.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But I said not ideal preparation, and actually it took United about half an hour to even mount an attack, didn't it, Paolo?
Yeah. Well, what we saw in the first half, I thought, and I appreciate Manchester United have been bad this season. I appreciate that this is not the first time where a team, even going back to the first game of the season with Leicester, has come there and has had more possession than they have. But it was beyond 70-30 for a lot of that first half, and I thought that was astonishing. I'm not saying that we should be stunned to find that Juventus are better than Manchester United, which they are, which a lot of us were saying before the game. That's a thing that a lot of us expected. But this is still Old Trafford. It's still a team that you expect to see, I don't know, with a bit more about it than that, with a bit more combat in it, with a bit more resolve than having any team, even a very, very good team like Juventus, come there and just absolutely own the pitch, not just the game, but the whole pitch, and do precisely whatever they felt like. And the only wonder in this scenario is that they managed to keep it to one goal, which says a lot about David De Gea and not that much about Manchester United's defending as a whole.
Yeah, I think from the first minute, one of the things I really noticed is United players just didn't want the ball. Juventus, they just controlled the midfield. United players would get the ball and everyone would back off. And it's to see that Old Trafford, as you say, in a home game for United is just bizarre, isn't it, Barry?
It's becoming increasingly less bizarre, I think. It would be unthinkable under the reign of Sir Alex Ferguson. But these days, you know, we all know that Jose prefers to be reactive and let the other team have the ball, and because he thinks if we don't have the ball we can't make mistakes, and that's, it couldn't be more wrong really. as we're finding out this season. But yeah, as 1-0 wins go, it could scarcely have been more emphatic, and yet Paul Pogba hit the upright with a shot that could easily have gone in, and they could have got a point they really didn't deserve.
Yeah, I mean, apart from that, Jose after the game was, all he wanted to talk about really was Chiellini and Bonucci, how good they were, mentioned they could go to Harvard University to give classes on how to be a central defender. But actually, did they have that much to do?
Well, Chiellini, of all people, probably could, because he's got his...
He could go to Harvard and give classes on many things.
Well, yeah.
He's a very smart guy.
I'm trying to remember now if he's got the full doctorate or if it's just a master's for now in economics. But yeah, he's an intelligent guy. But Baz is right. The Pogba very nearly scored. It wasn't, or at least didn't feel to me like the result of some... Although United were better in the second half, didn't feel like the result of some brilliant passage of play. It was Paul Pogba, who is a player capable of excellent things, doing... something on his own which nearly worked out and caught Chesney off guard. I didn't feel like Chiellini or Bonucci was particularly troubled. I think that actually this Juventus team, as good as it is, can be got at. I think that Bonucci has been at fault on, I think, 5 of the 6 goals they've conceded already this season. They're not keeping clean sheets as consistently as they were. Chesney's a good keeper, but they're not as sort of confident, I don't think, in that area of the pitch as they were with Buffon was behind the defence. They're not invulnerable, this Juventus team, and probably if United had a little bit of confidence, they might even have been able to cause them some trouble. But the issue, as stated before, was getting the ball off them, because Bentancur, I thought, was quietly superb in that midfield, managing the game and not giving the ball away. Pjanic is a player who I've got a huge amount of time for, and who absolutely plays the simple, effective pass. He talked about that in the interview which he did with us last week. He's a tremendous manager of a game. Manchester United don't have any of that control in the middle of the park. So yes, Paul Pogba can do something on his own, and maybe on the right day that shot goes in. But it's not the result of anything, anything ingrained, anything that's sustainable in that midfield or in that team in the way it's playing.
And De Gea made a couple of really good saves from Ronaldo, who otherwise wasn't one of his better games, but I suppose he caused them problems.
Well, he was still the one who put the ball in for the goal, wasn't he? I know it took a nice deflection,
yeah,
but it was still him who did that. And I think he has the effect on Juventus so far this season of just sort of dragging them forward a little bit. He's one of those players who, by his presence, by his constant desire, even in a day where, yes, he didn't necessarily have a demonstrable influence like he can have, his desire to score goals, his desire to get on the ball, his desire to push opponents back, I think does have an impact on the whole mentality and positioning of the team.
I think with Ronaldo, the legs aren't what they were, or they certainly weren't what they were when he was a player at Old Trafford. But I mean, there was those two shots that De Gea made, but you know, the power he gets behind those shots.
Mm. Yeah, the free kick in particular.
Yeah, yeah, and it's it reminds me, and a friend of mine said this to me. It reminds me of Alan Shearer, late period when Shearer's, you know, had bad ankle injuries and knee injuries, and so just built up his legs to the point where it's almost like this, I don't know, swinging sort of war machine and just smashing the ball at such power, so that it just I mean, that Ronaldo flits in and out of games. That's what he's taught himself to do in the last half a decade or so, but he was so dangerous the whole time. Going back to Mourinho, what he was saying about the centre backs, do we not think that was a little bit pointed, considering that? Because he said that, oh yeah, they had Chiellini, had Barzagli, and he says, and then they went and got Bonucci, which is him talking about the fact that Manchester United did not sign a centre back in the summer, which he's still quite obsessed about. Having said that, I thought Manchester United's two best players on the night were probably Chris Smalling and Victor Lindelof, who I think had his best game so far for United. So a bit unfortunate for Jose's agenda. He'll keep pushing it though, won't he?
Yeah, I think afterwards he said something like, we have to go with what we've got, having spent £423 million or whatever it is. But well, it was United's fourth home defeat in 13 games. That's as many as they'd had in their previous 81, which says a lot.
Jonathan Wilson has written a wonderfully waspish article making fun of Jose's moaning, post-match moaning, you know. And again, he had the hand up with the three fingers, and Jonathan surmised it was possibly to signify the three signings he made during the summer, none of whom actually played against Juventus.
Well, elsewhere in Group H, young boys drew with Valencia. Juve only need a point against United now at home to qualify. United remain second on 4 points. No such trouble for Man City. They became the first English team to beat Shakhtar on Ukrainian soil, and a great performance from them, John.
Yes, I think actually in the first half, that might actually be the best City have played this season, which is, I mean, we're talking about a great team here, but I really don't think City have quite kicked into gear. The thing is, my friends in the statistics world tell me their XG and X everything else is better than it has been even last season, but it was the amount of chance creation in that first half against Shakhtar, a pretty decent team. Mahrez had plenty of chances, and the player I probably would pick out actually was a player that came on as a sub for Kevin De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva. Now, when Bernardo Silva played for Monaco, I thought what a great young player he was and how good he was. I think it was the under-21 championship, and I was worried he wouldn't get enough football for City because they had David Silva and De Bruyne, but it was actually watching that All or Nothing documentary I realised how often he's played and how effective a player he's actually been for City, and that just shows you that, you know, you can buy players, young players, and push them into the team slowly, carefully, until they become an important part of the squad, which is maybe something that the chap who won't go into hotel football might learn from.
Yeah, I think he scored within 1:26.
Exactly, and it was a great finish as well.
And as you say, they did create so many chances and still won 3-0, which says it all, really.
Yes.
I think they could have done better. For all their dominance, and any praise for City should come with the caveat that Shakhtar were missing in Marlos and Tyson. Their two standout players were both injured, both midfielders, so that was a huge blow for them. I saw some Ukrainian journalists liking it to Barcelona missing two Messis, so you know they were that automatically put them at a disadvantage, which is not to take away from City. I think City would have beaten them regardless, but even at two up and creating chance after chance after chance, Shakhtar never looked out of it, and they always looked like they might get a goal, which would have made things very interesting. And then when the third one went in with whatever 20 minutes to go, that was it, game over. But before this game, Pep Guardiola, I wouldn't say he criticised City's fans, but I think it was tacit criticism, where he was saying that they needed to get behind the team in Europe and be more interested in the Champions League, and you know, because the team couldn't win it without them, and he does, seems to think City aren't ready to win the Champions League, which I think is nonsense, but anyway. But I just thought that was a strange time to say that, on the eve of an away game in Ukraine, where 612 people had made the journey, presumably at great expense. And, you know, I just thought it was a poorly timed comment.
Is he suggesting that more should have gone? Or?
No, I think it was just generally because, you know, at Manchester City, they tend not to sell out home Champions League games. Manchester City fans took again UEFA a few years ago, and they don't seem as keen on the competition as say they are on winning the Premier League, and as is entirely their right. But I just thought, on the even, if I was one of those 612 fans who travelled and I heard these comments, I'd feel a bit aggrieved.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I think that City brought in Pep Guardiola to win the Champions League. That's the, you know, end of mission really for them if they get there. And I suppose it must be weird to suddenly turn around and see that the fans don't get into the competition. Why that is,
yeah, that's,
I don't know.
It's been the case, hasn't it, with booing the
well, it goes back to the financial fair play thing, and it also goes back to the fans went to a game in Moscow playing, I think it was CSKA Moscow, who were banned. They were banned from any fans being in the stadium, and the City fans that travelled were also not allowed to go into the game. And this was taken as a great affront. And if you were a City fan that had made that trip, you probably would feel aggrieved. But collectively, they took against it. And I think also that there is this view maybe among Manchester City fans that the Champions League belongs to Manchester United, Juventus, Real Madrid, Barcelona, teams that Manchester City are not. And that they're a sort of outsider club of that. But the thing is, the fans might think that, but I think that the owners definitely want to be within that cartel. They want to be part of the top table.
Well, they're going well. City top Group F with 6 points. Elsewhere in that group, Hoffenheim snatched a stoppage time equaliser to draw 3-3 with Lyon. onto Tottenham, drew 2-2 with PSV. They just Tottenham just made a real mess of this. There's no other way to say it. The 2-1 up, they're cruising. They wasted chances. They had plenty of the ball.
Are you saying they were a little Spursy?
they were. I actually watched this game with a Spurs fan, and I said, "Oh, just give me a definition of Spurs. You know, this Spursy saying from a Tottenham fan, because we always hear it from Arsenal fans and anyone else." And literally, I said that, Lloris came flying out of his area, and he went, "Well, Hugo Lloris, it's Spursy." Just
well, Hugo Lloris is almost sort of embodying it in one man form, isn't it? Because he's a very good goalkeeper, yeah. Right? Like, he's an excellent goalkeeper who makes a lot of important saves and sometimes wins them big games. But in this Champions League, yeah, against Barcelona, he went for a stroll, and it's the same thing here. Like, he sort of has these little moments. And heaven knows what he was thinking last night. And it wasn't the only thing that happened in this game that could be given that moniker either. Because, of course, the first goal, Toby Alderweireld just takes too long to get rid of the ball. And if that doesn't happen, then they're never behind in the first place.
He had a terrible game, actually, didn't he, Alderweireld? I'm not sure I've seen him have such a poor game.
Yeah, yes, I think Irving Lozano deserves, you know, we can give him some credit to PSV because they did have a certain courage to them and kept bringing the ball, bringing the game to Tottenham. But I mean, it's still a game that Tottenham should have won by 2 or 3 goals. So it's sort of one of those where you can rightly highlight all these criticisms and still wonder, well, hang on, how didn't they win, especially with the one goal which they can very rightly feel aggrieved about that was disallowed for offside that shouldn't have been.
Yeah, and they will say that it is wrongly disallowed. Kane wasn't interfering with play, but still, that was at 1-0 down. They equalised. It wasn't like that was at 2-1 to put them 3-1 up, was it? Can they really use that as much of an excuse?
No, not at all. And I think Eriksen set up the goal for Harry Kane, which was another piece of Eriksen genius, of which we see pretty regularly these days. And at that point you thought they'd put them away. But Hugo Lloris has had an interesting few months or weeks, hasn't he? A legal matter included.
Are you suggesting his goalkeeper's superpowers come from the steering wheel of his car and now he's no longer allowed to drive it?
Well, possibly, yes.
He's waning.
Even amid, the... I feel, France won the World Cup. Hugo Lloris was the goalkeeper, captain of France. But in amidst that party celebration that we've seen videos of, do you reckon Hugo was sat there thinking about the mistake he made for the second Croatia? Do you reckon that sort of cast this shadow over him for the months since? He just hasn't been the same since, has he?
No, and you know, yeah, it was a rush of blood to the head when he came racing out, but he really didn't need to. There was two defenders there. Yeah. It was outside the box. There wasn't that much danger for him to make that decision.
No, just made one broadcasting observation. Glenn Hoddle was the commentator on this game. Now, Glenn Hoddle is, of course, one of Tottenham's finest ever players. Now, I think Christian Eriksen is a very, very good playmaker who happens to play in Glenn Hoddle's position. And I couldn't help noticing how critical Glenn Hoddle was of Christian Eriksen. I'm just, you know, maybe a bit of professional jealousy there, you know.
Interesting.
I didn't particularly notice, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Glenn Hoddle doesn't tend to offer that many opinions. He's as a summariser, he's more of a banal, this is what just happened.
Yeah.
Kind of guy.
But I just picked up on this sort of, there's a chance that Eriksen had running through on goal, and he hit the ball hard, but straight at the goalkeeper, and Glenn is saying, oh, he should have, you know, you can't hit that there or anything like that. And you just think, what, are you saying that you would have done better, Glenn?
Well, he probably would. The PSV goalkeeper actually had a very good game. His name is Zoot. And every time I heard it, I couldn't resist a little chuckle because he's named after the saxophonist from the Muppet Show house band.
Paolo Pochettino after this game said they've basically got not a lot of chance of getting through. There's a stat that suggests he's absolutely right. Of 67 teams to have had 1 point after three Champions League group games, only seven have progressed to the knockouts. They go to Camp Nou as well in their last game.
Arsenal, one of them.
Yeah, Arsenal have done it, and Liverpool have done it.
And Newcastle,
I think, 2003 and 2007. Possibly. Newcastle maybe even have no points after three games. Or am I misremembering?
Possibly. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's possible.
This season.
Look, here's your optimistic take from Tottenham's point of view. Inter were a long way behind Barcelona in their game. They lost 2-0 last night. So if Inter lose again to Barcelona at home, then even if they beat PSV at home, they'll have 9 points going into the final round. Obviously, Tottenham need to beat them at home. And Tottenham's I've got the order wrong there, because of course Tottenham's last game will be against a Barcelona team that theoretically could have won the group already. So Tottenham could still get to 10 points, and there's a way you can see that Inter get stuck on 9 points, which is if they beat PSV, lose to Barcelona, lose to Tottenham. So it's not done, but they've certainly made their life a lot harder, and it's, you know, it's an uphill climb.
Yeah, only a 2-0 win for Barcelona, but it was much more comfortable than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, Inter were never really in this game. And, of course, no Leo Messi, so they might have thought that they had a chance. But the take in Italy is, Raja Nainggolan is more important to Inter than Messi is to Barcelona, because Nainggolan is missing for Inter. I think that's more than a bit of a stretch. I think that even with Raja Nainggolan, there's a very good chance this Inter team would have found itself outclassed. They had won 7 games in a row across all competitions coming into this one, so there was a certain degree of optimism there. But I think if you're looking at the detail of those performances, well, there's been some good in them. Inter are still very much a work in progress under Luciano Spalletti, whereas Barcelona, you can take Messi away and they still know how to play.
It was Rafinha, wasn't it, that played instead of Messi?
Yeah. Oh, that was Suarez's ball to Rafinha for the first goal, yeah, was just absolutely sublime, wasn't it?
Well, Rafinha, I think this is what John was probably thinking of, was it at Inter last season on loan?
Yes.
And would have liked to stay. He actually gave an interview just this last week saying, I thought that I was going to stay there and I would have liked it, basically, because he was starting every week at Inter, whereas at Barcelona he's been back on the bench again. So it is a sort of a little bit of a one in the eye, and especially because the reason they didn't sign him, it was financial fair play was the issue. Inter had limited funds, but nevertheless, if they hadn't decided to go after Nainggolan, then they might have had Rafinha. And personally, as good as Nainggolan is, and he has decided games for them, I think that this Inter team might have done well to focus a little bit less on, we need to be physical, we need to be strong over on the pitch, and go for that robustness which Nainggolan gives, and so that actually Rafinha's a good sort of technical player who had done very well from last season. I think they could do with him.
Now, Paolo said Lionel Messi was not there.
Oh, the director knew he was there.
Yes, that's true.
Every given moment, he zoomed in, didn't he?
Rafinha, his replacement, touched the ball. There was, you know, benevolent Leo sat on the arm in sling.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
He looked like he was actually really enjoying not having to play football, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like, he looked like, this is great. I'm just sitting here and watching a team win. That's fun. Yeah.
It was also an amazing moment when Luis Suarez took a free kick and the Inter wall all jumped and Brozovic just slid behind the wall to block the effort on the floor because he knew Suarez was going to go underneath them.
Yeah, that looked to me like it must have been discussed. Like, it wasn't like he sort of looked like he had a last minute thought. It looked like he was waiting there and planned to do that. But yeah, it was definitely a humorous moment seeing him do it. And it worked.
Didn't someone at Brighton do that earlier this season where a player kind of knelt behind the wall to avoid such an outcome, or I possibly dreamt it.
That Chris Hughton's a wily one.
I just remember seeing it and being, oh wow, yeah, amazing, no one's ever thought of that before.
Well,
it was Anthony Knockhart. A voice has just said in my ear, thank you, producer Sammy.
There you go. Brozovic had the same idea anyway. Paolo, just a final point on Inter. They've won just one of their last 9 European away games. Mm-hmm. On home turf, though, they are a different proposition, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's now a defining game in the group for them at home to Barcelona. Messi probably still isn't going to be back for it. I wouldn't necessarily expect them, I don't expect them to suddenly, because they're at home, outclass Barcelona. I think Barcelona will probably dominate possession there, will probably have control of the game. But they have shown an impressive capacity for getting results this season, Inter, for showing that ability to dig things out. Obviously, the Tottenham game is a prime example of that. Mauro Icardi is a striker who gets it. You give him one chance and he'll often take it. So at home, with the crowd behind them, they certainly have a better chance of doing something against Barcelona.
Well, that's all for part one. In part two, we'll start with Liverpool, who turned on the style against Red Star Belgrade. Welcome back to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. In that little off-air interlude, we were just talking about goal music, and producer Sammy has found PSV Eindhoven's goal music from last night, which was... which I think is the best goal music I've ever heard.
Is it taking you back to a podium in that nightclub in Norwich with the ball pit in it that I've heard you speak so highly of?
I haven't actually been while the ball pit is in there because I'm 29 now and I'm way too old to do that. Mercy, that is. There isn't really poles in there, but there are sort of staged dance areas where that song has been played and I have been on them. But that's not why I love it. I just think it's great. I think the key with goal music is playing it as, you know, the ball hits there and then you play it. Not like at
Norwich.
Then
the offside flag goes up and it's, oh no.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's
or in the case of West Ham, you push the bubble machine.
Yeah.
Yes. And I've seen the bubble machine pressed and, there'd be, you know, lost bubbles floating in the air.
I have actually, well, not petitioned, but there was a survey on Twitter a few years ago about goal music at Norwich.
Yeah.
And I encouraged all my friends to vote no. Should there be goal music at Carrow Road? No, because I really don't like it. But the key is pressing it quickly. Sometimes at Norwich it's so late, the players are sort of running back to the halfway line and then the darts music kicks in. Oh no, it's too late.
Would you have voted yes if it was that track?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe I should start a petition to change it to that. I don't know the name, I'll have to Spotify.
Is it Ajax Amsterdam, isn't there? Bob Marley.
Oh, yes.
Two little birds or three little birds?
Oh, learn something new from you, John.
Yes, Radio 2 Popmasters, here we come.
On to Liverpool. Beat Red Star Belgrade 4-0. Really, really comfortable. And the front three really, really performing again and back in the goals.
Yes, and I suppose there's been a few concerns about them, Salah in particular, but he got to 50 goals...
50 goals in 65 games, I think.
Yeah, the quickest ever to do it. The quickest before that was Albert Stubbins, who needed 77 matches. Albert Stubbins is also famous for being on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There you go, continuing
wow,
the
radio. Another thing I've learned from you, John.
Yes.
Who'd have thought? But as well as they did, Shaqiri didn't get on the score sheet, but he has got all the plaudits from this performance. He did really well.
Yeah, I think Shaqiri is a decent addition, a budget price addition. I think it was only 13 million.
Yeah, bargain.
Red Star Belgrade is a fixture, which is very key, actually, in Liverpool's history, going back 45 years. They lost to the Red Star in 1973, and that changed Liverpool as a European club. Taught them to keep the ball, pass and move and so on. But it's a very different club. I mean, Barry wrote a piece about Red Star a few weeks ago about how different that is to the club that I certainly remember growing up, when Red Star Belgrade were one of the biggest and best teams in Europe.
Yeah, they famously won the worst European Cup final, and possibly any cup final.
The worst match I've ever seen.
Ever,
yeah.
Of all time. Beating, who was it, Marseille?
Marseille, yeah.
Chris Waddle was playing. But, yeah, I mean, they were always going to be the group whipping boys. They got off to a good start in their opening game, got a draw, but they had no fans at Anfield last night either. They were banned from travelling for reasons I can't remember. And, you know, it was a good performance from Liverpool, but I think it's nice to see Red Star back in Europe, even though some of their fans are rather unsavoury.
Well, Sadio Mane had gone 7 games without a goal. He missed a penalty, then got a goal anyway. Firmino had gone 6 without a goal and then got one. And I mentioned Shaqiri. Gary Neville was getting a lot of stick on Twitter because he called Shaqiri lazy earlier this season. And for the first goal, he actually tracked back, won the ball back, threaded a lovely ball free to Robertson, who then put the ball in for Firmino. Neville's reply was quite funny. He said, I hope you lot are going to message me every time you see him stood on the halfway line whilst your team are being attacked. So...
I think his criticism was fair. At Stoke, Shaqiri didn't seem interested, and you'd every right to question his professionalism, and I think plenty of Stoke fans did.
And Charlie Adam, actually, his teammate, has done in public as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you know, obviously Jurgen Klopp, either he's bucked up his ideas because he got a move to a big club, or... Jurgen Klopp just wouldn't stand for that kind of stuff. But people can change, you know. It doesn't make Gary Neville's criticism any less valid.
There's also another point here, which, yeah, I mean, people can change, and it's very possible by the end of this season we can look at Shaqiri and say that. But the whole point is, if your criticism of someone is that they're sometimes lazy and intermittent, you can't answer that with "in this one game." You have to answer that with "in these 38 games" or "in these 40 games."
Yes.
Like, yeah, that's exactly the point. Shaqiri was the same at Inter. He had a couple of really good games, and he also disappeared in games, and you need to have consistency to prove that wrong. You can't prove it wrong by having what he did have this, you know, this Wednesday night, one good game.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's had more than that, to be fair, this season. I'm not trying to say that either, but yeah, just the point is that he needs to show it over a longer time before you can even really rebut something.
Well, it's wide open in Group C. That's after PSG drew with Napoli. A brilliant, brilliant goal from Angel Di Maria, rescuing a point for PSG in stoppage time. And actually, though, Paolo, they were fortunate, weren't they, to get a point from this game?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think probably, I would say, on balance over 90 minutes, two all felt about fair to me. But it was definitely a situation in which you thought Napoli had the points. And it was, in the end, both of PSG's goals, for all that attacking talent they have. The first one is an own goal from Mario Rui off what's a really terrible cross, by the way, that's not going to cause any problems at all from Meunier. So just a flat defensive mistake and error. And then the second one, yeah, a wonderful goal from Angel Di Maria, and a bit like we were talking about with Pogba earlier, and the fact that he had that shot that could have brought United back into the game. It was just one player on his own going, well, you know what, I'm really good and I can put the ball in from here, and there's not a lot you can do about it. But actually, where was the sort of... You know, where was this end product for a team that has Di Maria, Neymar, Mbappe, Cavani? Where was the sort of spellbinding football that a group like that should be able to produce? It was mostly absent. And Napoli, as a team, looked far more coherent and cohesive. They could have scored more. Mertens hit the bar early on. I can't speak highly enough of the job Carlo Ancelotti has done at Napoli, and that there's obviously a lot that he's inherited from Maurizio Sarri that is good, but he's changed the formation. He hasn't just sort of kept the team exactly as it was. He's using the team differently. He's using far more players than Sarri ever did there. I think he's already used 21 players this season, where Sarri was sort of notoriously rigid in sticking to his starting lineup. He's evolved the team to a point where guys like Callejon, who was undroppable, guys like Hamzik, who was undroppable under Sarri, are regularly not there, and the team still wins. They are really good. They're still in a really tight position in this group. This whole group is really tight, really, for those three teams. But Napoli, having drawn that first game with Red Star, looked like they were in a hole. So to come back and beat Liverpool, draw away to PSG, they've brought it right back into a situation where, yeah, right now they're probably, I'd say, slightly favoured over to PSG to get through this group.
You mentioned Neymar. He flattened to deceive again. He was rested at the weekend. Didn't really create much at all, did he?
So Neymar almost sort of epitomised what I was just talking about. There were times in this game where I thought Neymar looked brilliant. Like, and he gets on the ball, and I don't think you could accuse him of not working hard enough, of not trying. And he gets on the ball, and he beats men, and he was doing that on Wednesday. He was beating his man. He was sort of creating a sort of forward thrust for PSG at times when other players weren't. But again, it still feels too much like, well, there's Neymar doing his thing on his own. Well, how does it all fit together? And that sort of actually surprised me a little bit, because I haven't had a tremendous amount of opportunity to watch them in Ligue 1 this season, but that's exactly what I'd heard, is that Tuchel's team is beginning to look like Thomas Tuchel's team, and actually, you know, it is starting to look fluent and cohesive, and I didn't see that in this game.
The Neymar thing, to me, it still looks like such a vanity project. There were stories about maybe the beginning of this year where he appeared to be allowed to behave by Unai Emery, actually, like as some sort of spoiled Bourbon Dauphin or something like that. But I wonder, if PSG go into the Europa League, does that make Neymar eligible for transfer to a club in the Champions League? I think it does.
Yeah, I think it does under the rules, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's how Alexis Sanchez was able to go to Manchester United. The Neymar thing, his destiny does appear to lie back in Spain. Now, obviously, that's a big project to get him back to Spain. But you do wonder if in January there might be a few stories about him wanting to, you know, going back to Spain if they drop into the Europa League. But to me, I would suggest, I mean, when I look at PSG's squad, I see players like Neymar, Angel Di Maria, Cavani, all the players we know, and then there's that lower tranche of players who do not seem of the same level, or of a level good enough to play with players of that quality. If they're able to cash out Neymar and maybe buy in four or five players, then PSG's dream of being at that top table of European football, that would seem to be easy, better. You would be able to reach it far easier than just having an individualist in their team, I would suggest.
Isn't it strange, and just what you were saying about Emery there, I read a very interesting interview he did after he left PSG and before he took the Arsenal job, and he didn't have to be careful about what he said about anything, but he happily conceded that, you know, he said at certain clubs someone's the boss. Neymar was the boss of PSG,
right, yeah.
You know, and you know the Florentino Perez is the boss at Real, and Jose is the boss at Manchester United. But yeah, he conceded that. But it's weird that Neymar seems to be, well, he is one of the best players in the world, and yet he hamstrings both teams he's in, Brazilian team and the PSG team. And it just seems to me like there's an immaturity there that in years to come he could end up looking back on, you know, God, what a waste, because, you know, teams I was in could have won so much more if I hadn't been such a twat, for want of a better word.
he had a turbulent week, Neymar. He split up with his girlfriend, apparently, Brazilian actress. He also had two tattoos done on his back, sort of on his shoulder blades, one of Spider-Man, one of Batman, which...
I thought you were going to say that he split with his girlfriend and got something hostile towards his girlfriend tattooed on his back, which would be a really...
Did she leave him because he got a tattoo of Spider-Man and Batman?
She said it was his decision, I read.
Okay.
It wasn't like Johnny Depp and Winona Ryder or anything like that.
No, I don't think there's animosity.
Well, no, he had... But Johnny Depp had Winona tattooed.
Oh, of course, the tattoo.
And he changed it to Wino.
Well, maybe her name was on his back, and he needed, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Spider-Man to.
Also, how long had he been with her?
I read on and off for 6 years. So
okay,
make of that what you will.
On and off sounds interesting.
Well, enough of Neymar, because we need to talk about Dortmund. 4-0 win over Atletico Madrid. Incredible performance by them. They top Group A. And the biggest defeat of the Simeone era, John.
Yes, I think Dortmund are probably the best team to watch in Europe at the moment. And, okay, so their last seven matches, they beat Nuremberg 7-0, beat Leverkusen 4-2, beat Monaco 3-0, beat Augsburg 4-3, played Aachen in a friendly, won that 4-0. Played Stuttgart 4-0, 4-0 against Atletico. That's an outstanding run of form.
30 goals, I make that. Just off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible run of form.
Good maths there.
Yes, very good.
Quick.
Lucien Favre, the manager, is someone, I mean, he did a decent job at Nice, but I think at Dortmund they've always been looking for someone to succeed the Klopp here. I mean, Thomas Tuchel did a pretty decent job there, but then they had a misfire with Peter Bosz and stuff, so on and so forth. And then Dortmund, I think, benefit from the fact that they are seen as a club where young players want to go. Of course, Englishman Jadon Sancho's there. And
scored his first Champions League goal last night as well.
Yes. And, you know, you look at Dembele, who's at Barcelona, and then he went there, made himself into a top player, goes to Barcelona, becomes rich beyond his wildest dreams. And Dortmund is one of those clubs, maybe a little bit like Monaco was a couple of years ago, where every young player wants to be and has that crop of young players. I do wonder whether they've got the financial might to hold on to those players, but they just seem to have a production line of them at the moment.
I was just running through the team from last night, thinking about that, what John was saying about young players. If you include Jadon Sancho off the bench, you've got three teenagers in the team. So Sancho, Hakimi and Zagadou. You've got a couple of 20-year-olds, Larsson and Pulisic on the wings. You've got another couple of, you know, 21, 22-year-olds. It is a really young team to be playing sort of so confidently in Europe. Is hugely impressive. And you think all these young players and then surrounded with a couple of guys through the middle of that attack. Obviously, Royce leading the line and Gertz just behind him. Who, good players, but slightly sort of viewed in not so distant times as, the tier slightly below the best of German football. The guys who hadn't quite, you know, managed to maintain the level that was expected of them as young players. It's a really fascinating blend as a team, but it's certainly working, isn't it?
And in Group A's other match, it was Thierry Henry's first Champions League game as Monaco drew 1-1 away at Club Brugge. That was their first point of the campaign as well. Elsewhere, Real Madrid ended their winless streak. Unconvincing win though against Czech champions Victoria Pilsen. Benzema and Marcello with the goals, but Pilsen did waste three really good chances in front of goal. Roma are second in Group G with a comfortable 3-0 win over CSKA Moscow. Dzeko scored two and assisted the other. We just have to mention on CSKA Moscow that awful video that's been doing the rounds on social media of the escalator at the metro station in Rome. About 20 fans, mostly CSKA, injured. Awful scenes. Obviously, we wish them the best. In Group B, Ajax and Bayern are first and second on 7 points after wins over AEK Athens and Benfica. They can both qualify for the last 16 with wins in the next match day. Finally, in Group D, Lokomotiv Moscow lost 3-1 at home to Porto. In the other game, it was Galatasaray 0, Schalke 0. Let's go back to the Premier League on Monday night. Feels a long time ago. Arsenal 3, Leicester 1. A really, really impressive performance by Arsenal. And it's got a lot of their fans excited again that Emery can finally deliver the sort of football that Wenger used to deliver in his glory days.
Well, can I say that it was Arsenal were great in the second half, or the last 15 minutes of the first half. They played really, really well. The song is, "We've got our Arsenal back." Which is interesting, considering, you know, Stan Kroenke has taken over the club and so on and so forth. But you've got this club; they're playing the flowing football that, in their mind's eye, they can remember Arsenal playing. And I suppose what that does say is how, in Arsene Wenger's later years, that the team Arsenal became quite boring to watch. Hmm. They played a passing game; they passed it around nicely. Some nice pretty patterns. Mesut Ozil's been in the team for 5 years now, but it wasn't lifting Arsenal fans out of their seats. And that was a game where Ozil scored to become, I think, is it the top goal-scoring German?
Yeah, 30 goals in the Premier League.
In Premier League. And I, I was in the office of the day and was asked to write a piece about, you know, whether Arsenal could challenge for the Premier League for the first time in almost a generation. I don't think so, but I do think they can challenge for a Champions League position. And, you know, them being in the Europa League and being able to play a understrength team in that means that they've got a good shot at getting back into the Champions League. It shows you that Emery has got the team running harder. He's got them having more shots and so on. It just shows you that the decay that's set in under the Arsene Wenger regime. I think I feel a bit uncomfortable about the criticism Wenger gets from that, from the Arsenal fans, because of what he did for the club. But I think it's okay for them to celebrate the team playing good football.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned they were good in the second half, because actually in the first half, Chilwell obviously put Leicester ahead, and they did play a little bit like they were under Arsene Wenger. There was a little bit of unrest in the stadium, because they didn't start well at all. 16 out of 23 of their goals this season have come in the second half. Does that tell us anything, Paolo?
It's certainly the way that Emery is currently using the squad. It tells you that, I mean, the story of this game, that it's very handy being able to bring Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang off the bench and add him to your attack. It was fascinating what sort of happened. It started with Lichtsteiner at left-back. And Stefan Lichtsteiner, I don't know how much he's got left in the tank generally, but he's certainly not a left-back at this point. What sort of happened was Xhaka goes out to left-back and Aubameyang joins the left of the attack. And that first goal, it's just like no one in Leicester is ready for a player like Aubameyang, someone who is so effective at those runs into the box, at timing them, at knowing, to be coming in from that angle, to be coming in from the back post. And basically both goals, exactly the same thing. Aubameyang's just having, I mean, he'd better been on the pitch for about a minute by the time he scored that first goal. He's having a wonderful time playing not that many minutes, but when he comes onto the pitch, just knowing that teams aren't ready to deal with him and that he can make those runs and find himself in 10 yards of space to tap the ball into an empty net. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that John said. I don't believe that many Arsenal fans are taking seriously the idea that that they can win the league, but Arsenal fans are enjoying watching goals like the ones that were scored against Leicester, like the goals that were scored against Fulham. It's fun to watch Arsenal at the moment, and that's okay.
Aubameyang scored a Premier League goal once every 105 minutes as well, which is the best goals to minutes ratio. I don't know over what period. That's a stat I saw, and I couldn't work that out in the time frame. But still, in incredible form.
Yeah, and it's good that he seems happy to not be an automatic first pick. You know, my concern about Arsenal, and I have been very impressed with them, and I think they could come second. I don't think the challenge is for the title. I don't think anyone will, apart from City. But in this run of games, wins, what is it, 10 now, the best teams they've beaten have been Everton and Watford.
And they were very bad
Leicester
against Everton for a lot of that game. No,
I'm not, you know, we will see what they're made of when, I think their first game is a game of against a big six team is against Liverpool. I saw Merce has predicted that Liverpool will absolutely tear them apart. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, you're sniggering. I think Merce is, you know, I know he's not very good at pronouncing foreign names, but he's got a pretty shrewd football brain.
I do agree with you, Barry. I think just because Merce is, you know, not the most eloquent of people, he has his own way of saying things, but when he says, I ain't having him, about a player, you tend to look at it and think he's probably correct about that player. I do think he understands football, yeah.
So he has predicted, as I said, that Liverpool absolutely tear Arsenal asunder. I think he was saying if Arsenal play or start games slowly as they have done and as they did against Leicester. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Arsenal get truly tested by the big boys.
Get truly beaten by Liverpool.
I think they'll do all right.
But I think that even if Arsenal get beaten by Liverpool, this still doesn't invalidate the fact that actually to be able to win all your games against everyone else will take you a very long way.
No, absolutely.
If they can keep it up.
And the fans are happy. They haven't been happy for a long time. And at the end of the day, that's why you go to football, to be entertained, to get away from the grind of work and whatever, and hating Arsene Wenger.
We should mention they were perhaps fortunate not to concede a penalty, Rob Holding handball that wasn't given. Leicester fans were pretty incensed about that, as was Claude Puel.
Was it really, though? Can he be incensed?
Yeah, good point. I tell you what I did notice about him. Did you see what he was wearing? Oh. Awful. He had a gilet on, but then a suit jacket over top. So yeah, nice. He was wearing a gilet like, as if you would wear a waistcoat in a three-piece suit. A couple of really bad fashion sense, actually, on the touchline. Mourinho was wearing an Adidas T-shirt with a really thin roll neck over top, so you could see the Adidas logo. I mean, surely a man
Edward must have been delighted by the product placement for that.
Yeah, that's true.
But company man, Jose, you know.
You'd think he could afford a thicker one.
I don't think I've ever worn a waistcoat with a suit. Certainly never worn a gilet. But,
does not surprise me. Anyway, moving on. Arsenal face Sporting Lisbon tonight in the Europa League. Also in the Europa League, Celtic travel to RB Leipzig. Chelsea host Bate Borisov and Rangers host Spartak Moscow. That's all for part two, though. In part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League games and also round up the Football League action from this week too. Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Just before we move on to the football, just something to tell you about. Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Every weekday you'll hear a different side to the news from those at the heart of the story. Today in Focus brings you personal stories and fresh perspectives so you get a deeper understanding of the world. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Let's get on then to the Football League roundup. Full programme of action this week. Norwich moved into fourth place with a win over Dean Smith's Aston Villa thanks to two second-half goals from Jordan Rhodes. And I'm not going to go on about it because I feel like I'll be too biased because I am a Norwich fan. No one else here probably cares that much. But our second goal was really something of quality and the sort of football that we hoped Daniel Farke would bring with him when he arrived a year and a half ago. And we're finally producing it.
It was fantastic. I would say it was probably wasn't because it wasn't as speedy, but right up there with the two, you know, the Arsenal goal against Leicester and the Arsenal goal against Fulham. I was surprised to see your team scale such lofty heights. I didn't realise they were third now, are they?
Up to fourth now, yeah.
Fourth.
It was a
really remarkable goal. Were people starting to lose patience with Mr. Farke?
A little bit. We ended last season quite badly. He's never done that well at home, and he's finally now getting home wins, which is good. Well, it's Leeds who are back at the top after beating Ipswich 2-0. Ipswich bottom, and there's a lot of speculation now about Paul Hurst's future. West Brom have now lost two in a row after being thrashed at home 4-1 by Derby. What have we got to call them, John?
Frank Lampard's Derby.
Of course. Who are, we should say, really gaining momentum. Bizarre little Twitter spat after this game between huge Derby County fan Niall Horan of One Direction fame.
Frank Lampard's Derby fan.
Yeah, Lampard's Derby. Who said about how nice Derby were to watch, and somebody tweeted him saying, "What about Leeds?" And he tweeted back, "No one likes Leeds." And the official club Twitter account obviously saw this, and they replied, "No one likes your solo career, hashtag bring back 1D. And the replies to this underneath are just so good, because obviously there's a lot of Niall Horan fans who just search his name on Twitter and they've seen this come up, and there's sort of American teenagers who are really having a go at Leeds.
So even fewer people like Leeds.
People who didn't even know Leeds existed now dislike Leeds.
One of them says, "No one likes y'all. Try again next time, hun. Niall's solo career is greater than anything you'll ever accomplish." At the Leeds official account.
You're greater than the 29 game unbeaten run at the start of the 73-4 season. That is an absolute outrage.
It's just really, really funny to see some of those. Middlesbrough are second. They drew 0-0 with Rotherham, who pick up their first away point. And Charlie Adam denied Sheffield United another win. His late free kick grabbed Stoke a point. Sheffield United are now third. Some big games at the weekend as well in the Championship. Middlesbrough against Derby and
Frank
Leeds.
Lampard's Derby.
Yeah, oh yeah, I forgot, sorry. And then Leeds against Forest as well. The evening kick-off on Saturday. In League One, Peterborough gained points on the on top spot after their 1-0 win over Fleetwood. Portsmouth came from behind to draw 2-2 at Burton, and Sunderland are close behind in third as Chris Maguire's goal gave them victory at Doncaster. In League 2, MK Dons won their fifth consecutive game at home. That was against Notts County. They're now within 4 points of Lincoln City, who could only draw against Carlisle. Cambridge United moved out of the relegation zone. With a 2-0 away win at Swindon Town. So since Max has been off this pod, they've drawn against the league leaders and now won. So that's, well, should he ever come back? Maybe that's for the good of his club.
Is this you officially throwing your hat in the ring?
Well, I'm not sure I'm quite established enough to do that, but... You know, if ever there was a reason, it would be to save your football club from dropping out of the Football League. Cheltenham have dropped into the bottom two. Just going back to League One, we obviously always put out requests for questions. This is less of a question and more of a plea to highlight the plight of Bradford City. Their fan Michael Brett got in touch to say it's the worst start to a campaign in their history. They have the worst record in the Football League in 2018. They're onto their fourth different manager of this year. He wanted that mention. I'm not sure that will ease the pain, but...
It's a howl of anguish. Yeah, I'm not sure airing it so publicly will help the situation, but who knows? I don't even... We were discussing this earlier. I didn't know who the boss of Bradford was. I assume it's always Stuart McCall, and that whenever they do badly and he gets sacked, then he becomes caretaker manager of his own job, then gets it again.
It's another ginger Scotsman, though, David Hopkin, who played for Bradford in the late 90s. I saw that tweet and I looked through the Bradford squad and I noticed that they had a Sherwin Sadoff, and I thought, oh, you know. So I looked up his Wikipedia and it says personal life. I thought, there we go. And it says he is distantly related to Clarence Sadoff, so he's even his son
pretend
or his
cousin.
Distantly related.
Distantly related is a great sort of euphemistic way of saying it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah.
So we should mention they lost 4-2 to Coventry, their ninth defeat in 11 games. Really not looking good for them. Anyway, on to Premier League games this weekend. I suppose the standout one, apart from obviously Tottenham and City's Monday night, we'll get onto that. But the big one is Southampton-Newcastle in terms of matters at the other end of the table. Southampton not scored in four consecutive games. Newcastle looking pretty hopeless as well. Has this got a draw written all over it?
Well, you've got two managers there in Mark Hughes and Rafa Benitez, in which one of them claims it's never his fault and the other one, it probably isn't his fault. So it's a battle of... That's the dynamic for me in this one. I was up in Newcastle a couple of weeks ago, one of my favourite cities. And, you know, you talk a lot of football when you're up there. Now, you know, it oscillates between misery and optimism quite readily. But I think I've rarely seen such pessimism about the team as I saw a couple of weeks ago. Not a lot of hope there, really. But I mean, I've seen a few people try to question Rafa Benitez at this point. Get the impression that a few fans are maybe turning on Benitez a little bit because of the rather reactive football that he tries to play. But ultimately, he doesn't have a lot to work with, does he?
I feel like Norwich perhaps have sort of distorted a stat, really, because it's their worst. We mentioned on Monday, it's Newcastle's worst start, even worse than when they were under Steve McLaren, when Norwich went to St James's Park and lost 6-2 and they hadn't won a game and just defended like the relegation fodder that we were that season. But yeah, the optimism was probably lower then, and then that boosted them, but that's a huge game, really. Mark Hughes as well, under a little bit of pressure at Southampton?
You'd imagine so. I don't understand why he keeps getting jobs. Baffles me. I think he may well be a very nice fellow, I don't know, but I just am astonished he keeps getting high profile work when he's clearly not very good at it.
Well, he would argue that
he would blame the referee.
Well, yes. I don't think he's been relegated. He's actually managed clubs that ended up getting relegated at the end of that season, but he's never, I think, been in that position himself. I think actually if you went back 10 years and when he was a manager of Blackburn, you'd probably consider him actually a promising young manager. And they played, you know, when Blackburn had Benny McCarthy, David Bentley, players like that, a very decent team. And Mark Hughes was one of those managers that you would have thought might get a bigger job. He got the Manchester City job. It didn't go well for him. And then it's been diminishing returns. Did an all right job at Stoke, I suppose, at a certain point, but they got bored of him.
I don't think he did, though.
Well, they finished, I think they finished 10th, 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 and then started going down from that point. Listen, Stoke City are a lot worse than they were when Mark Hughes was doing an okay job.
Any other fixtures from the weekend that catch your eye, gents?
Not a huge number. The outcome of the Man U Everton game will be very interesting on Sunday afternoon. There's, given United's home form, I think there's every chance Everton could beat them. And I'm kind of looking forward to Fulham Bournemouth. I think the way Fulham are defending, Bournemouth could absolutely skittle them with that forward line. So.
And we mentioned Tottenham against Man City. That's Monday night, but just a quick word on that. That's a great Monday night football, actually. First good one for a while.
Yeah, well, we're sort of touching it with the idea of our Arsenal in this title race. And I agree with what Baz said. I think by the end of the season, City are going to separate themselves. But right now, you have got, from first to fifth in the Premier League, a 2-point gap. So it is fascinating. Like, it is really sort of well poised at this point of the season. Tottenham, if they play like they did against PSV, you can't imagine City not exploiting that. You can't imagine City being anything but ruthless with the sort of opportunities they presented in midweek. But Tottenham still won 4 in a row for all the in the league, at least.
Their best Premier League start, we shouldn't forget that.
Exactly, for all the sort of sense that they're not quite where they should be, in some ways you could spin it the other way and say, well, this is encouraging, isn't it? They're not quite where they should be. They're not quite... they keep doing these things that undermine the quality they have, but despite all that, they're only 2 points behind. Yeah, like there's a positive way of looking at that story as well. So I think it's a very intriguing game.
Barry, you spotted something on the internet this week regarding Pep Guardiola, didn't you?
I was worried about what you were going to say there.
we don't talk about things like that on the pod.
The BBC have got the UK's second most debonair Spaniard, Guillaume Balaguer, to interview the UK's most debonair Spaniard, Pep Guardiola, to ask. It's sort of like a Desert Island Discs, but without the luxury item or the book.
What would that be, a chalkboard or something?
I would imagine a tactics board.
Yeah.
And copy of Inverting the Pyramid is what Pep would bring. But, they've asked him to... Well, it's just an interview and punctuated by the six songs that define my life, love, football and family. And it's very interesting. You can download it from iPlayer, and I would recommend doing so. But, yeah, his choice of songs was kind of interesting, an eclectic mix. He Don't Look Back in Anger by Oasis. The Healing Day by Bill Fay. New York, New York by Frank Sinatra. Your Song by Elton John.
Wow.
New York, New York. Did he choose that because he lived in New York?
He did mention that he enjoyed his time in New York.
You wonder if the Oasis, he had to throw an Oasis one, didn't you, really?
I just love the image of Pep at the end of a heavy night. Arms linked over shoulders with everyone, kicking the legs out, New York, New York. It's just, it's
like
not quite...
like the end of a wedding.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, the end of a wedding pick.
And then he had a couple of Catalan songs, which I was unfamiliar with, and I found them on YouTube. Pep says, I'm not shy to say how I love my people. Maybe the opposite. Maybe I say too many times how I love them. In that I feel so Latin. My face or my body language always expresses perfectly what I feel in that moment. I'm not escaping or hiding. People, then talking about himself and his football team, people believe we are like ice, cold, a machine that is far away from who we really are. But the two Catalan songs he picked were Fiesta by an artist called Juan Manuel Serrat and Amor Particular by Lewis Lack. who's apparently a famous Catalan troubadour. So, you know, maybe producer Sammy could dig that out and play us out with a more particular... It certainly moved this cynical journalist's black, stony heart.
I wonder if Pep has seen Moulin Rouge, because this is controversial, but to my mind, Ewan McGregor's version of your song on the Moulin Rouge soundtrack is actually much better than the Elton John original. Wrong.
I haven't seen Moulin
Rouge.
It's
the end crescendo. It's so...
Yeah, my housemate put that on just the other day. It's not as good as Elton John's. That's,
really?
That's wrong.
I heard the Moulin Rouge. That came out when I was 11, that film. And I saw the film before I'd ever heard the Elton John song. And then I heard the Elton John song and I was really like, oh, what? Give me Ewan McGregor back.
Sorry, just you were asking, Melissa, Pep on Don't Look Back in Anger. I love this song. You cannot imagine how much. It is incredible. It puts me in the best of myself when I listen. It's a masterpiece. Every time we go out, we always sing this song together. I love it.
Oh, that's painted a really lovely picture of Pep when he's out. Don't Look Back in Anger, New York, New York.
That's another end of the night song, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Swaying arm in arm.
Basically, Pep, if you're having a wedding, invite Pep.
Yeah.
He'd be the first man with the tie around the head, knee slides across the dance floor.
A fiesta and amor.
Particular.
Particular. Are those both sort of, you know,
no,
rabble-rousing?
No, they're not.
That brings us to the end of the pod. Before we go, obviously I've just stepped in for these two pods while Max has been off, and I'm sure everyone can't wait to have Max Rushton back on Monday, which he will be. There has been some feedback. I couldn't catch some of the comments because they get moderated quite quickly below the line.
Sorry, I took screen grabs. It's
you
fine.
You did take of one, which was, she sounds about 12, which I was really pleased about because I always think I sound about 8, so I sound 4 years older. I'm quite pleased. And then someone called Gutman, I don't know if that, how you pronounce it, says, not bad, but it did sound like upper sixth radio from a posh girls' school, of which my mum will be so pleased because her dream was for me to go to a posh girls' school called Norwich High School for Girls in Norwich, and instead I went to Cossey High School, as it was called then, which was almost the polar opposite. And he also sort of painted this little scenario where he said, Barry, you were the head of geography. I think it was you anyway. It said Mr. Glenn Denig, but...
Right.
We can get from that typo that it was you. He said Jonathan Wilson was a little bit subdued as he was doing his Buasella Ofsted planning. I can only assume he means Bielsa. And then Mr. McGuinness, spelt how Paddy McGuinness spells his name.
Top Gear.
Yeah. So he was on the pod. he was apparently trying to ingratiate himself by saying he's from the same town. I can't let this go because one of my biggest bugbears is when people call Norwich a town when it's actually a city which has not just one cathedral but two and is, you know, the metropolis of East Anglia. I can't let that go.
I'm glad that you got that off your chest. I think you had big boots to fill. I think you filled them more than admirably. So congratulations.
Well, I've enjoyed it and thank you for having me is all I can say. And thank you for coming on, John Bruin.
I've enjoyed it very much.
And Paolo, thanks for your time.
Cheers.
And Barry, thanks to you too.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's all for today. Max is back on Monday.
Sé feliç quan veig la teva força que empeny i que es revolta, que jo
for more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.